A shadow of good things to come. I hope you don't get tired of that, because God worked throughout all of history up until the time of Jesus, putting those shadows in, designing, moving, changing history to, in every way imaginable, tell the world and His people, particularly us even, that what He was doing. This helped ensure that what Jesus did was no accident. It was not some manipulation by Jesus to make things come out as they did. It was no fabrication by the early church, first and second century, because these things were already there, hundreds, even over 1,000 years before. And now what we want to start looking at today has to do with the foreshadowing of Jesus in the priesthood of the Old Testament. In the book of Hebrews, we've already referred to this passage before. Of course, our statement in Hebrews 10 about these things were a shadow of good things to come and not the very things themselves. But if we go a little earlier into the book of Hebrews, in Hebrews chapter 5, the writer of Hebrews is trying to tell his readers that he recognizes some of the things he's talking about here are difficult for them to grasp. And so he says in Hebrews 5 and in verse 11, "We have much to say about this, but it is hard to explain because you are slow to learn. In fact, though by this time you ought to be teachers of others, you need someone to teach you the elementary truths of God's Word all over again." Now think with me for a moment. He's writing to Jewish Christians. He's writing to Christians who all of their life, up until their conversion to Christ, and even since their conversion to Christ, have been intimately involved in the day-to-day religious ritual that was Judaism, that was given back at Sinai by God through Moses, that involved at that time a tabernacle which they built, an Ark of the Covenant which they built, the institution of a priesthood of the descendants through Levi of the sons of Aaron, a sacrificial system which we've already been talking about, of sin sacrifice, guilt and trespass offerings, burnt offerings, meal or grain offerings, drink offerings. We only refer to it in passing, even the fellowship offering. And still to come for us is even the festivals and feasts that God instituted at that time that they were to celebrate every year. And these people have, that's been the so-called warp and woof of their life. I have to admit, I no longer know what a warp and a woof is, but I've heard that all my life. What it means is that it's so intimately woven into their life, they thought nothing of it. That was life for them. But now they've become Christians. And what the writer of Hebrews is trying to tell them is that all of this they've known all of their life, all of it was pointing to Christ. And even though they've become Christians, they can't see that. Some of them are even being tempted, and some of them already have even fallen back and left Christianity for Judaism again. And the Hebrew writer over and over is saying to them, "Can't you see that all of that was pointing to this? And so now why would you want to leave this, that all of that for over 1,000 years was pointing to, and go back to that which just pointed to it? Why would you want to leave the reality for the shadow again?" So they were having a hard time grasping it. And he says that these are things that are hard to understand. But he says the reason they're hard to understand is because they were slow to learn. Now, we have a different problem. It's hard for us to understand it, not because we know it so intimately that we can't see beyond the immediate. We have the problem of being ignorant of it. We understand and know so little of that Old Testament system. We have so little a picture in our mind of the sacrificial system, of the temple and the tabernacle that was before it, of the Ark of the Covenant, of the whole ritual worship system that they had, the priesthood that ministered all of that. We understand so little of it, that's why we have a hard time understanding Hebrews. Our problem is just the exact opposite of theirs. They knew too much, we know too little. Nevertheless, we hope to, in some small measure, move beyond that as we keep looking at these things having to do with a shadow of good things to come. The temple and the priesthood was very much a part of the life and times of Jesus. Even though it had been instituted originally through Moses at Sinai, perhaps as long as 1,400 years before Jesus came into the world, and it had been practiced mostly consistently by the Jewish people in Jerusalem from that, once they came into the land and under David built the temple, or Solomon built the temple, right until the time of Jesus. Nevertheless, there were some problems with it in Jesus' time. After all those centuries, by Jesus' time, the priesthood, part of it at least, the upper echelon of it involving the high priest and his family, it had become a political office. It had become almost strictly a power position. It no longer was primarily seen by the men themselves who held that position as their duty, their opportunity to go to God on behalf of their people and represent their people before God as they sought His forgiveness and blessings. And now instead it was used as a means for politics, power, and money. In Jesus' time, it was the high priest and his family who controlled the concession industry that allowed so many to sell doves and lambs and exchange money and all sorts of things that were going on in the outer courts of the temple that Jesus came in two different times and uprooted and overturned and drove out. And they got a percentage of everything that was sold and done. If the Roman governor, like Pontius Pilate, wanted to get anything done with the Jews, he had to negotiate with the high priest for it. The high priest was political. As far as all the ceremonies the high priest was involved in, it seems that by Jesus' time, the high priest himself no longer even really believed it was something that he was doing toward God. It was a ceremony. It was a custom. It was a practice. The high priest and his family were a part of the Sadducees. These were the less spiritual, more worldly-minded part of the Jewish leadership. They did not believe in life after this life. They did not believe in angels. They did not believe any part of the Old Testament was even from God except the first five books. It is said that some of them were even believed to have been ancient form of atheists. But they still carried on the ceremonies. This is the world into which Jesus was born, in which the very thing God had created all those centuries before to prepare for His coming had evolved into this. Now, many of the ordinary people still very much believed in it. Some of the priesthood, not in the high priest family, but many of the others, were still very devoted to it and believed it was just what it ought to be. We've heard, perhaps, of the Dead Sea Scrolls. What's significant about the Dead Sea Scrolls are several things. One of them is the oldest copies of some parts of the Old Testament we have. But what we also need to understand is who were the people that made the Dead Sea Scrolls. It was a group of Jewish people who had become so dissatisfied, so unhappy with the worldliness and detachment of the high priest and his family and everything that went on up at the temple in Jerusalem. They had become convinced that God was no longer happy with that and no longer even accepted the sacrifices that were going on up there. So they withdrew from Jewish society and started their own community out on the shores of the Dead Sea, which today is referred to as the Qumran community. And for over 100 years, they lived out there trying to be the people who were devoted to God. They were a kind of restoration movement of their day, trying to get back to the simplicity and the devotion that existed in Moses' day for God, because they saw what was going on in Jerusalem as so corrupted and so far removed from what God originally intended it to be that they didn't want to have anything to do with it. And of course, that situation going on in Jerusalem and in the temple and with the high priest and what they were doing, they are the ones who ultimately pass the sentence and execute the judgment to have Jesus himself killed. And yet they were the ones who were supposed to be looking forward to His coming. They were the ones who day after day were doing the very things that were pointing to Jesus. And just like the priest was to kill the lamb for the blood of the people, sure enough, that's just what they did. They killed the Lamb of God so He could take away the sins of the world. But all of that, whether it was the New Testament and the way it was practiced then, or if we go back into the Old Testament and try to read about it in the days of Solomon, or go back to when it was instituted in the book of Leviticus and in Exodus, all of this seems so strange and unfamiliar to us because we don't have anything like it in our culture or perhaps even in our world today to compare it to. So we have to use the word pictures in the Scriptures themselves to try to understand it. I think if somehow we could suddenly be transported into the middle of something going on at the temple, Old Testament or New Testament times, those surroundings would seem so bizarre to us, even barbaric from certain points of view. And yet it was something that Moses and David and Isaiah and Jesus and even Saul of Tarsus, who was later Paul the Apostle, knew so well. But just something that was so well understood by them. I read somewhere, and I really like the thought that's behind it, that what we need to do when we look at what's going on in the Old Testament and in Exodus and Leviticus and even what was still going on at the temple in Jesus' day, as corrupted as it was in some ways, we need to realize that what we're seeing and even what the people then were seeing is a morality play. Do you understand what a morality play is? We understand what plays are. A play is where a story is being told by actors. People have different parts. They do different things. And they're entertainment. But a morality play is more than just entertainment. Yes, you still have actors. You still have a story. But a morality play is telling another story in addition to the actual one you're seeing on the stage. It is a kind of figurative story. What's being acted out there is figurative of something else going on. And God had this thing He was going to do with Jesus. So He moves back in time, 100 years, 500 years, 1,000 years, 1,400 years. And He starts having His people day after day, year after year, century after century, act out a morality play. So they would be ready when the real story was told to see the connection between one and the other. But so many of them didn't. To them, the play was the important thing, not what the play was about. And so they missed the point. The Hebrew writer is trying to tell his readers that. Let's see if I can tell something of the story. And I know it's based simply on my own reading of the accounts we have in Exodus and Leviticus of how it was supposed to be set up. And what little bit we have after that of how they carried on from time to time. But we start out, if we're transported back to this time, here before us is a magnificent facility. Now, if it was in Moses' day, it would be the tabernacle, newly built and finished. By comparison to the later temple built by Solomon, or even the greater one built by Herod just before Jesus' time, it would be quite small, but it would still be magnificent, especially in contrast to everything around it. Here is something made out of the finest materials, beautiful, and it's purple and blue and gold, fine burnished wood, the best of everything, right in the middle of a desert filled with dirt and drudgery and people just sort of scratching out a living. And yet, here right in the middle of all of that is this beautiful, magnificent facility. The same could be said when the temple was actually built by Solomon. It may not have been the grandest building in the world in its day, but as compared to everything around it, it was amazing. All built out of limestone and the finest woods and finished inside and out. It's a wonder and a glory. And it's not just the facility itself, it's what's going on there. Constantly, day after day, you see all these ceremonies being carried on, all these services being conducted. There are light stands that are lit every morning, or rather every evening, and burn all night long to keep it illuminated, even when all the rest of the area around is in darkness, because there were no street lights in those days, and yet they kept the temple area illumined all night, every night. And every morning, as soon as the sun rises, there's a sacrifice that goes on and a big ceremony that's conducted without. Every evening as the sun goes down, another ceremony. All during the day, people are coming up to the temple. And they come in the morning and the evening for prayer. They come up there with their offerings. They come up there with their sacrifices. Those who have broken God's law in some way are bringing their sin offerings. Those who have trespassed against a brother in the Jewish community bring their trespass offerings. When a child is born at the appropriate time, male or female, it's brought up to the temple for the things that should be done. When someone is cured of a disease, they come up to the temple. It was a very center of everything that happened in their culture. And there with all this magnificence and these ceremonies that are going on constantly by men wearing very special outfits, their priestly garments that were very different than the usual garments that people wore, especially once the temple itself was built. If you looked, here was this magnificent building and this huge doors that opened up, and on either side of the doors, two large pillars, 27 feet tall, it says. They'd even named these huge brass pillars. They were called Jachin and Boaz. Jachin and Boaz, which meant stability and strength. For God intended for this to be an enduring thing. But as those doors were opened up every morning by the priest, only the priest could go inside, but even the worshipers could look, and if they looked carefully, they could look into what was inside. And in addition, in this place called the Holy Place, you could see the golden lampstand that was kept filled with oil and kept burning, that illumined the inside of the Holy Place. You could see the table of the showbread, and if you looked carefully at the very back of the Holy Place, there was a curtain, big, magnificent, deep burgundy or purple curtain hanging, and right in front of it was a small altar up on a stand, which constantly you could see smoke going up from it up into the ceiling, called the altar of incense. And though you never got to see it, ordinary people never got to see it, you knew that behind that curtain was the Ark of the Covenant, built specifically at the instructions of Moses, specially constructed out of the common wood that was found in the desert down in the Sinai, and then overlaid with gold, with the angels or cherubim on top, inside the two tables of the covenant, the Ten Commandments. A jar holding a sample, hundreds of years later, of the manna that they had been fed in the wilderness. And the cane, or the crook that Aaron had carried with him out of Egypt, the rod. And once a year, the high priest would go behind that curtain to make sacrifice before the very Ark of the Covenant that existed between God and His people. Once a year, something very special happened. There were all the regular ceremonies, of course, that went on every day, but once a year, at a time that is still referred to today in Jewish life, even though they no longer are able to practice the ceremony, is called Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement. And on this day, look, there's the high priest. He's dressed in his finest. Already the ordinary priest wore special white garments made out of, the scriptures say, linen. But it's not necessarily linen the way we think of it today. Their word for linen actually described the extra fine white cotton material that came from Egypt. And I think the ladies know that still some of the best cotton in the world is the fine cotton of Egypt. And you always want to get your bed linens and so forth out of Egyptian cotton if you can. And yet that's what their robes were made out of. These fine white robes, and tied around their waist was a sash. We would think of it as a belt, but that wouldn't be quite appropriate because it doesn't have a buckle and all of that. But it was a woven, embroidered material that was tied around their waist. And on their head would be a kind of turban, a small cap that was made especially for the occasion. They were always barefoot. They never wore shoes when they served before God. Always barefoot. That was the regular priest. But then comes the high priest. And on top of some of the things the regular priest had, he would have a special, his garment or robe would be blue instead of white. And then over that, he would wear something called the ephod. It would actually be a frontlet and a backlet that were fastened together at his shoulder. It was ornately decorated and come down about to his waist. And then attached to the front of that was the breastplate, about a 10-inch square, highly decorated, very expensive, valuable breastplate with 12 large precious stones set in it, one for each of the 12 tribes of Israel. And again, around his robe and the ephod, as it was called, was this sash that he wore that was tied in the front. It didn't go down around his waist, but it came up just beneath his breast, and it was tied there. He wore a very special turban on his head, much larger and more ornate than that of the average priest. And the front of it had a gold band attached to it around the front. And on that gold band was engraved, "Holy to the Lord." And he comes on this day, dressed in all of his finery, for this special ceremony that's described in Leviticus 16 as the Day of Atonement. And as he comes, scholars today believe that one of the first things that would have to happen is that all that finery he wears, he takes off and replaces it with just the dress of an ordinary priest. For on this day, he is no better than his fellow man. Even though he's at the top of the list in terms of his position, for what he's about to do today, he is no better and no different than anyone else. So when he takes off all of this finery he has on, the gold, the beautiful robes and the ephod and the breastplate, and replace it with just a simple priest robe and their sash and their turban, and the ceremony begins. And the first thing that has to happen, and the whole community of Israel is gathered, thousands and tens of thousands of people are gathered here to watch as this all takes place in front of them. The first thing that he does is he takes two animals, a bull and a ram. And first he lays his hand on the head of the bull and he cuts its throat. He kills it. He makes sin sacrifice for himself. For what he's about to do requires that he be truly holy to the Lord. So he makes a sin sacrifice. Then after that is done, then he takes the ram. And again, he puts his hand on it to transfer what's happening to it. And he kills it. And a burnt offering is made. So after he makes his sin sacrifice, then he makes his worship sacrifice. He takes the blood that is caught from the bull. And he has to then go into the holy place in front of all the people. Everybody's watching him. And he puts some incense on the altar there, and he sprinkles some blood on the altar of incense in front of the curtain, and then he pulls the curtain aside and he goes into the most holy place. He disappears from sight. But there in the most holy place, he stands before the Ark of the Covenant, where for hundreds of years, the true eternal flame burned just above the mercy seat, the top covering. God made sure that His presence was always signified by this flame that was there. And He sprinkles the blood of His own sin offering, the offering for His own sins, there in front of the mercy seat of God. And after that's done, now He comes back out. A great relief to all the people. For it is recorded in history that either two or three high priests actually died while back there in the presence of God. Whether it was just from the tension and the fear of the moment and they died of heart attacks, or they were not acceptable to God and He actually struck them dead, we don't know. But history has recorded, I forget at the moment, whether it was two or three high priests who actually died while in the carrying out of their duties there once a year before the Ark of the Covenant. But they come back out, and now they come back out in front of all the people. They've now made sacrifice for their own sins, but now it's time to represent the people. And two goats are brought. And a lot is cast. In other words, it's sort of a way of choosing that's not under the control of the one doing the casting of the lots. And one of the goats is specified now as the sacrifice, and the other one is now specified as the scapegoat. The elders of the people come forward. They all put their hands on the scapegoat and symbolically transfer the sins of the people onto the head of this animal. Someone is there waiting whose only job is now to take this scapegoat immediately and lead him out of the temple area, outside of the city, and out into the wilderness where nobody knows where he is, and turn him loose. He's free to go. Hopefully will never be seen again. Their sins, symbolically, have been taken away. But there's the other goat. He's the sin offering. He's not so fortunate. Now the elders lay their hands on his head, and the high priest cuts his throat. The blood is caught. He goes now with this blood once again into the holy place, to the back. The curtain is pulled aside just enough for him to go in behind the curtain. And the blood is sprinkled and poured out before the Ark of the Covenant for the sins of the people. He comes back out. The people are waiting in great anticipation and expectation. For now it's been done for another year. The sacrifice for their sins has been made. God has promised them that if they do this year after year, that their sins will be hidden from His sight by them doing these things. Strange to us. Unfamiliar. If it wasn't for us reading it in the Scriptures, we couldn't even imagine such a thing. But that's what happened. And they did it year after year. It was, by most ways of looking at it, the highlight, the Jewish year, the 10th day of the 7th month. It was so important that actually the only fast that God ever commanded His people to participate in, He commanded many feast days, but He only commanded one fast day. It was a fast day that began at sundown the night before the Day of Atonement. They fasted for 24 hours in preparation for this time. We're going to spend several weeks looking at and talking about the priests and the priesthood and how all of this fits in to Jesus being the fulfillment of those things. I just want to say a couple of things very briefly at this point. First of all, we need to realize that the Old Testament said that when the Messiah came, He would be both priest and king. For some reason, by the time it gets down to Jesus' time, they seem to have forgotten that. They kept looking for the king. They kept looking for the Messiah who was going to be king. They forgot that God had promised that He would be both priest and king. Another thing we need to realize is that temple and those sacrifices, that holy place, that most holy place, the Ark of the Covenant, the presence of God, were only symbolically so. As the Hebrew writer reminds us, the real most holy place is in heaven. And where the real sacrifice is going to be made is before God's throne in heaven, not on earth. A couple of little side notes about this. Once the priest was elevated to high priest, and he could only be a direct descendant of Aaron, who was the high priest. Once he was elevated to high priest, according to Leviticus chapter 21, as long as he served as high priest, he could never leave the precinct, the area around the tabernacle or the temple, as long as he served as high priest. Even if his mother or his father died, he could not leave the temple to attend their funeral. He must stay on duty, figuratively speaking, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, for the entire length of his high priesthood. You ever wondered why, when Jesus went back to heaven, he stayed there? He's still on duty. He's still serving as high priest. Another little thing to note, at the beginning of the book of Revelation, we have this very interesting thing. John talks about how that he was in the Spirit on the Lord's Day on the island of Patmos because of the Word of God and the testimony of Jesus. And that's when he starts having his revelation. But one of the very first thing he sees in this revelation he receives, he says, "I turned around to see the voice that was speaking to me. And when I turned, I saw 7 golden lampstands. And among the lampstands was someone like a son of man, dressed in a robe reaching down to his feet with a golden sash around his chest." Who is it? is Jesus. But do you know what John saw? Jesus was dressed in the priestly robes. He was on duty, even as he speaks to John. 7 golden lampstands and the old covenant in the holy place was those golden lampstands that represented the tribes of Israel that were kept lit inside of the holy place. There's so much more to be said about this. I hope we've at least piqued your interest a little bit to hear more about it. What all this garb the high priest wore, what all these ceremonies meant, how do they relate to Jesus? What story was God trying to tell as He had them do all these things back here? How do they tie in with what Jesus did and is doing and will do in His role now as both priest and king?